and a diced salt fruit. "This meal is yours," Lazmet said, "if you will tell me how you got into this manor."
"What?"
Akos had fixated on the food. The rest of the room went dark around him. His stomach was beginning to ache. "Someone must have helped you get into this house," Lazmet said patiently. "None of our outer locks were disabled or tampered with, and you could not possibly have scaled the wall without someone noticing. So tell me who it was that let you in, and you may eat this meal." Jorek, long, skinny arms and patchy facial hair. He had taken the ring that Akos wore around his neck before they left the storyteller's home for safekeeping. He had offered his arm to his mother to stabilize her on the cobblestone. "Jorek is a good man," he reminded himself. "He didn't even want to let you into the manor. You manipulated him into doing it." He couldn't possibly give Jorek's name to Lazmet in exchange for a meal. "Tell me your mission." "No," he thought, to the Ema that lived in his head. "Not this. I won't do this." Ema had told him to look for an opportunity to give Lazmet information, to show him something was changing, to keep him from getting bored. Well, this was it, served on a plate. "I don't believe you." Akos closed his eyes. "I think you'll take the food away the second I tell you what you want to know." "I won't," Lazmet said. He stepped away from the plate. "Here. I'll even back away. Trust me in this simple thing, Akos. I do not delight in pain. I want to see what you will do, and it doesn't serve me to withhold something from you once you've done as I asked. Surely you see the logic in that." Akos's eyes pricked with tears. He was so hungry. He was so tired. He needed to do as Ema said. "Is your mission to be loyal to your family, your friends, your nation?" No, that was not his mission. "Kuzar," he choked out. "Jorek Kuzar." Lazmet nodded. He walked away from the table and took his seat in the armchair, leaving Akos to his meal. The feather grass had turned sour in his stomach. It kept coming back up in burps, the flavor rising in the back of his throat, reminding him. Akos touched the hollow of his throat, where the ring of Aura's family had once pressed. He wouldn't see it again. That didn't bother him so much. He never felt like he had earned it in the first place. Killing a man wasn't something that should get you welcomed into a family, he knew. But the thought of how Aura would look at him if he ever got out of here. He pressed his hand over his mouth as another burp came up. There came a tap at the wall panel next to the fireplace. It slid back to let Ema in. She looked more casual than usual, her white hair tied back, dressed in dark training clothes and soft shoes, her eerie blue eyes fixed on him. "Tell me," he said, voice wavering. "You did what was necessary," she said. "Tell me what happened," he snapped. She sighed. "Jorek has been arrested," she said. Akos tasted bile and bolted toward the bathroom. He had just made it to the toilet when he started heaving, throwing up everything he had eaten in Lazmet's sitting room. He waited out the stomach spasms with his forehead against the seat, tears leaking out of the corners of his eyes. Something cool pressed to the back of his neck. Ema drew him back and pressed the flusher. She took the wet cloth from his neck and used it to wipe his face, kneeling beside him. Her usually passive face looked weary now, the lines in her forehead and around her eyes more apparent than usual. It wasn't a bad thing. The night my husband Uzul and I decided that I would turn him in to Rizek, thus prematurely ending his life for the good of our cause, I sobbed so hard I pulled a muscle in my abdomen. "It hurt to stand up straight for a week," she said. "He had only months to live, you see, but those months..." She closed her eyes. "I wanted those months," she said, a few ticks later. She dabbed at the corner of Akos's mouth. "I loved him," she added simply, and she tossed the cloth into the sink. He expected her to get up, now that she had cleaned his face, but she didn't. Ema sat down on the floor, right next to the toilet, her shoulder leaning into the seat. After a tick, she put a hand on his shoulder, and the weight and her silent presence were comfort enough.
Chapter 44. Syra. My last view of Agra from above was one of glittering light. Then Issa ordered us to ready ourselves. Sifa and Etrek sat closest to the exit hatch. Issa and Tekka were on the nav deck, and I was with Aija, Rizek, whoever he was now, closest to them. I glanced at Aija to make sure that he had strapped himself in properly, and the straps were crossed over his chest, right over the sternum, where they should be. Launching through Agra's atmosphere required a sharp burst of energy, followed by a quick shutdown to break through the dense layer of shadow from beneath. Issa guided the ship down to the right elevation, angled us appropriately, and punched the button on the nav panel. We shot forward, the sudden force making my body slam into the straps that held me in. I gritted my teeth against the pressure. Issa switched off the ship's power, and we were swallowed by a darkness so complete, we may as well have disappeared. And then everything, the darkness, the pressure, the terror, and even some of my pain, fell away at once as Issa turned the ship's power back on, and we drifted among the stars. I had thought that Tekka, who last flew me across the galaxy, was a good pilot, but Issa was an artist. Her long fingers danced over the nav center, making small adjustments to Tekka's settings, and she guided us with unprecedented smoothness toward the current stream, so we could travel alongside it. It was a cool yellow now, touched with green, a sign that more time had passed than I realized since I first landed on Agra. "You don't mind Issa poking around at your nav center?" I said to Tekka, nudging her with my shoulder. We were on the nav deck. It was safe to walk around now that we were through the atmosphere, looking out at the depthless darkness in our path. I sometimes referred to it as nothingness, like most people did, but most of the time, I didn't think of it that way. Space was not a finite container, but that didn't mean it was empty. Asteroids, stars, planets, the current stream, space debris, ships, fragmented moons, undiscovered worlds. This was a place of endless possibility, and unfathomable freedom. It was not nothing. It was everything.
"What? Oh, no, I definitely want to smack her pokey little hands away," Tekka said, narrowing her eye at Issa, who was still busy with the controls. "But the ship likes her, so I'm keeping my mouth shut." I laughed a little.
It took me a few moments to realize the source of my sudden relief. My current shadows, which had burrowed under my skin again when we landed on Agra, now coasted on top of it. Their ache and sting were still present, but so diminished that I was nearly giddy with it. To one who is in pain all the time, even minor differences can be miracles of a sort.
We just got pinged by an assembly patrol, Issa announced.
Tekka and I exchanged an alarmed look.
They say they have an old warrant on a craft matching this description, Issa said, reading from the nav screen.
Warrant for what? Being Shotet? Etrek asked.
Could be for drugging and spacing Issa Benazit when we didn't want to go with her to assembly headquarters, Tekka suggested.
You did what to Issa Benazit? Issa said.
She had just murdered my brother in the hold. What else was I supposed to do? I said. Oh, I don't know. Give her a medal, Etrek said, waving his arms.
I glanced at Ija. He was eyeing Etrek like he was about to reach out and smack him. It was getting easier to think of Ija as two people in one body, or one new, blended person, since I saw so much of my brother, yet so little of him at once. It was Rizek's pride that made him chafe against Etrek cheering his murder, but it was Ija's passivity that tempered his reaction. They had, together, become something else. New, but not necessarily better. Time would tell.
Tell them the Ogryns lent us this craft and we don't know about the original crew, Tekka said to Issa. Should be convincing if you record your image on the sides. You don't sound Shotet at all.
Okay, Issa said. The rest of you get out of range.
We stood back while Issa activated the sights in the nav screen to record her message, in fitful Otherian. She was a talented liar, or an Ogryn. It would take days to get from Agra to Urek. I spent most of my time leaning over the table in the galley, drawing a map of Noavek Manor, floor by floor. I went through the servants' passages in my memory, again and again, feeling in the dark for notches and circles and false panels. I told myself it would be useful for the mission ahead of us, as well as a good way to avoid Sifa, but those weren't the only reasons I did it. I felt like recreating the place on paper was a way of purging myself of it, room by room. When I was done with this, that place would no longer exist to me. At least, that was the theory. When I was finished, I ordered Ija. I had taken to referring to him by that name, because that was the body he was in, and he hadn't yet objected, into the galley. The others had been confused by my inclusion of Ija in our little group, but I just told them I wanted to bring the oracles along, and no one asked any further questions. He stepped into the room with a wariness to his expression that made me think, unexpectedly, of Akos. Ignoring the sharp feeling that brought to my throat, I pointed at the drawings of Noavek Manor, labeled by floor in my jagged, unsteady handwriting. I want you to check these for accuracy, I said. It's difficult to recreate a place from memory.
Maybe you want to spend your days wading through memories of Noavek Manor, Ija said, sounding more like Rizek in that moment. But we do not.
I do not give a shit what you want, I snapped. This is the problem you have, the problem you've always had. You think you have hurt worse than anyone else in the galaxy. Well, no one cares about your story of woe. There is a war going on. Now check the damn drawings.
He stared at me for a few moments, then stepped toward the table and bent over the drawings. He surveyed the first one briefly, then reached for the pen I had left at the edge of the table,
and started redrawing the lines around the trophy room. I don't know Lazmet nearly as well as you do, I said, when I had calmed somewhat. Is there anything you can recall about him that might help us get to him? Strange habits, particular proclivities? Ija was silent for a while, stepping to the right to look at the next drawing. I wondered if I would have to bully him into answering my question the way I had bullied him into checking my maps, but then he spoke.
He reads mostly history, he said, in a strange, soft voice I had not heard from him before. He's obsessed with texture. All his rugs and clothes have to be soft. I heard him scolding one of the staff for starching his shirts too much once. She made them too stiff.
He gulped and scratched out one of the doorways I had marked, drawing it on the other side of a bedroom.
And he loves fruit. He used to have one of his transports smuggle in a particular variety from Trella, Altos Arva. It's often boiled down and used in smaller quantities as a sweetener, because most people can't handle how sweet it is raw. The rest of this looks fine.
He set the pen down and
straightened. You know you're only going to get one chance at him, right? I just said. Because once he knows you're there, once he knows what you're trying to do,
he'll control me with his current gift, I said. I know. Ija nodded.
Am I allowed to leave now, or are you going to threaten me with death again?
I flapped my hand at the door. A plan was beginning to come together in my mind. I leaned back against the counter and stared at the drawings, hoping for inspiration. We had to wait to get in touch with Jorek until we were in receiving range of Thuva, which was 4 days into the journey. By the time we reached it, I was tired of the smell of the recycled water, chemical, from the purification process, and the canned food we had been reheating on the galley's little stove, and the itchy fabric that covered my sleep pallet. I was also tired of the memories I had here, of lying clutched together with Akos on blankets, and bumping hands at the galley counter as we both reached for bowls, and trading sly looks over Tekka's head whenever she stood between us. It was the first time I had considered, and only for a moment, that the destruction of the Sojourn ship might have had a positive side. At least I wouldn't be able to return to my memories of him there. I felt sick at even the momentary deviation in my thoughts. There was nothing positive about the obliteration of my home and the loss of life that had accompanied it. I was just going mad, trapped in this ship. I was combing through my wet hair with my fingers when I heard thundering footsteps down the hall outside and stuck my head out of the bathroom to see who it was. Tekka was tripping toward me, barefoot and paler than usual.
What?
I said.
Jorek, she said. Jorek's been arrested.
How? I said. Wasn't he working as a guard at the manor? He's a Khuzar.
I talked to his mother.
Tekka came into the bathroom and started pacing, heedless of the puddles of water I had left while drying off. She left small footprints in her wake.
R.A. said last week they were contacted by Akos.
I felt his name as a kick to the stomach.
What?
I said. Akos was in Thuva. Akos was at home, outside of Hessa, pretending the war didn't exist.
He persuaded Jorek to let him into Noavek Manor. Jorek didn't want to, but he owed Akos a favor.
Tekka paced even faster.
And what did he intend to do in Noavek Manor? I demanded. Does she know? She suspects the obvious, Tekka said. That he went to do the same thing we're about to do.
I stepped back, leaned against the wall. I hated this, the moment the anger squirmed away. It was easier to boil with rage that Akos had abandoned me without a word. Easier to let that act confirm what I suspected about myself, that no one could stand me for long. But knowing that he had left me like that for a reason... Tekka went on.
A week after Akos got to the manor, Jorek was arrested. R.A. thinks...
Akos wouldn't have given Jorek's name, I said distantly, shaking my head. Something must have happened.
Everyone has a limit, Tekka said. It doesn't mean Akos meant to,
no, I said. You don't know him like I do. He just... wouldn't.
Fine, whatever, Tekka said, throwing up her hands. But Jorek is probably going to be executed, because you and I both know Lazmet Noavec doesn't just have people arrested and let them go.
I know, I shook my head. The thought of Akos in Noavec Manor again made me feel like screaming. He couldn't be there. Does she know if Akos is dead? I asked quietly.
One of her sources says no, Tekka said. Says he's being kept prisoner, but nobody knows why. What good can he do Lazmet?
It was a measure of exactly how much I feared my father that I didn't feel much relief. Lazmet's reasons for wanting people alive were worse than his reasons for wanting them dead. I had watched the work he did on my brother, the slow work of destroying and rebuilding him. The way he ensured his own future, his own legacy, by constructing his son in his own image. Now that Rizek was gone, would he do the same to Akos? How much harm had he already done?
I don't know, I said. But whatever it is, it's not good.
Tekka stopped pacing. We stood facing each other. The almost certain loss of two friends between us. I expected to feel the acute pain of grief, but there was nothing. The black hole in my chest had devoured every last feeling in my body, leaving me empty. Just a sack of skin held up by bone and muscle.
Well, Tekka said, let's go kill your dad then.
Chapter 45. Syra. From the moment Urek entered our view, a globe of swirling white, I felt like a countdown began. We had 3 days. 3 days to finish planning an assassination and carry it out. 3 days to end this war before it destroyed Thuva and Shotet both. I had never seen the skies above Voa so empty. In the distance there was a government patrol vessel, painted with the seal of the family Noavec. It was one of the newer ones, all diagonal lines, like it was perpetually diving. It gleamed in the hazy light of day. It was the only ship in sight.
Don't worry, Tekka said, likely noticing that the rest of us had gone silent. We're cloaked. We look like a patrol ship to them.
At that very moment, a red light flashed on the nav panel. Issa looked back at Tekka with eyebrows raised. It was a call, probably from the patrol vessel.
Patch them through,
Tekka said, unbuckling herself and moving to stand at Issa's shoulder.
This is patrol ship XA-774. Please identify yourself.
Patrol ship XA-993, what are you doing afloat, XA-774?
Tekka said, without faltering for even a moment.
I don't see you listed on the updated schedule.
She was pantomiming for Issa, pointing out the spot where Etrek's people had told us to land, urging her to move fast.
At what time was your schedule issued, 993?
1440, Tekka replied.
You're out of date. This one was issued at 1500 hours.
Ah, Tekka said. Our mistake. We'll make our way back to our docking station.
She slapped a hand over the switch to turn off our communicator.
Go!
Issa pressed hard on the accelerator with the heel of her hand, and we zoomed toward the landing spot. Tekka was nearly knocked off her feet by the sudden movement, so she clung to the back of Issa's chair as we lost altitude. Issa lowered the ship to the patch of empty rooftop on the outer rim of Voa that Etrek's contacts had indicated. "Is there really a patrol ship XA-993?" I asked. Tekka grinned.
"No. They only go up to 950.
Right after we touched down, before Issa could even turn off the engine, a group of people rushed toward the ship, carrying a huge stretch of fabric between them. I watched through the nav window as they threw the fabric over the ship, drawing it taut with long cords. As the hatch opened behind me, they completely covered the nav window. Etrek deboarded first, greeting a man with black hair long enough to brush his shoulders with a clasped hand. When I moved closer, I realized they had to be brothers, maybe even twins.
"Wow, you weren't kidding," the brother said. "Syra fucking Novak is with you."
"How did you know my middle name?" I said. He smiled and offered me a hand.
"My name is Zvit. Short for something so long, I don't even remember it myself. I'm Etrek's older brother."
"You probably don't want to shake my hand," I said. "You're welcome to shake Tekka's twice, though."
"Don't volunteer me for extra handshakes," Tekka said. "Hi, Tekka Sarupta."
"Here are some oracles," I said, gesturing behind me to Aija and Sifa. Zvit raised his eyebrows. We did the rest of the introductions under the cover of the cloth they had thrown on top of our ship, which looked sturdy and likely served as good camouflage. Then Zvit led us to the rooftop access door and down several flights of stairs. The stairwell had no windows and smelled like garbage, but I was glad it gave us shelter. I moved away from my brother, and I wasn't even sure which of them I meant, to skip ahead a few steps. "What's it like out there?" I asked Zvit, falling into step beside him.
"Well, at first there was a lot of looting," Zvit said.
A lock of hair fell against his cheek.
"Good for business. But then Lazmet took power, and that pretty much scared sense into everyone. He imposed a curfew, started rounding people up and arresting them, stuff like that. Bad for business."
"What business are you in, exactly?" I said.
"Smuggling," Zvit said.
His eyelids fell heavy over his eyes, narrowing them somewhat, and he had a mouth given to smiles. He gave me one then.
"Mostly medicine, but we smuggle whatever's lucrative. Supplies, weapons, whatever."
"Ever smuggle fruit?" I said.
"Fruit?"
Zvit raised his eyebrows. "Yeah. I need to get my hands on some Altos Arva. It's Trellin," I said. "And since imports from Trella are illegal..."
"Smuggling is the only option, I see."
Zvit tapped his chin with a finger. There was a bruise under his nail.
"I'll find out."
"If we had Altos Arva, we could use it to get into Noavek Manor undetected, pretending that Lazmet's customary shipment of it had arrived early. The guards likely wouldn't dare to risk Lazmet not getting what he wanted. They would let us right in."
"Hey," Zvit said, "you should probably cover up your head. That silver skin's conspicuous."
"Right." I had been prepared to obscure my face once we arrived in Voa, so I wore a long black coat with a hood. It was made of a light, tough material called marshite, imported, like most waterproof fabrics, from Pitha. I put the hood up, and Zvit opened the door at the bottom of the stairs to the bright light of day. The wind made the folds of my coat snap and billow as I walked. The streets of Voa were emptier than I had ever seen them before, full of scurrying men and women folded inward, eyes down. It had never been easier to disappear among them.
"It's not far," he said. "Are all your people keeping step?"
I looked over my shoulder. Everyone had their hoods up, so it was difficult to tell who was a smuggler and who wasn't. I counted a bright streak of hair, Tekka, and the bump of a knot atop a head, Etrek, the bridge of a freckled nose, Issa, and a loping gait, Sifa, and turned back. "Looks like it," I said. Zeet led us down two streets before approaching a small, ramshackle apartment building. A light above us flickered as he turned the key in the lock. The apartment beyond, on the ground level, was cramped and messy. There were tables and cabinets and chairs leaned up against the walls in the hallway. I stood aside as the others filed in, counting Tekka, Etrek, and Issa before I realized I had forgotten to check for Aija. Just as I felt the beginnings of panic, I saw him jogging toward the door. "What kept you?" I snapped. "Untied shoe," he said. "You know that you can just walk with an untied shoe for a street or two, right? It's not actually life-threatening." Aija just rolled his eyes and closed the door behind him. The apartment wasn't much. One room served as living room, dining room, and bedroom, the floor spread with slim mattresses, one of which had a hole with stuffing coming out of it. There was a bathroom, but the shower was just a pipe protruding from the ceiling, and there was no sink. Still, Zeet was heating water for tea when I went into the kitchen.
"We'll rest here tonight," Zeet said when I poked my head in.
"Need help?" I said.
"Not unless you're skilled in the dangerous art of chopping hush flower."
I raised an eyebrow at him.
"Oh, really? Full of surprises you are. Come chop it, then."
It was crowded, with two people in the kitchen, but I took a place at the cutting board, and he stood at the stove. He handed me the fresh hush flower, contained in a jar, and the gloves I would need to prepare them without poisoning myself, and pointed me toward the knife drawer. I set the hush flower on the cutting board, upside down, and pressed the flat of my knife to the place where the petals joined to split them apart. Then I sliced the dark red streak down the center of one of the petals, and it lay flat, as if by magic.
"Nice," Zeet said. "How did you learn?"
I paused. I was tempted to call Akos a friend, but it seemed too simple for what he had been to me. Too small a word.
"Ah, forget I asked," Zeet said, and he reached for a jar of something else, high up on the slanted shelves.
"Is this your place?" I asked. "Or someone else's?"
"It was my mother's, before she died. Chills and spills took her. That was before we had figured out how to smuggle medicine."
Zeet bent his head over the pot of water he had set on the only burner, and tapped the jar he held to dust the water with powdered fenzu shell. I kept chopping the hush flower. It was my family's fault that his mother had not had access to medicine. Lazmet had begun the practice of hoarding donated medicine from Othir, and Rizek had only continued it. I had gotten the expensive inoculation when I was a child. I was in love with him. "The one who taught me how to prepare hush flower," I said. I wasn't sure why I was telling him this, except that he had shared some pain with me, and I wanted to do the same. The exchange of suffering didn't have to be even, but it was a kind of currency, his sorrow for mine. A way toward trust. He left me. No explanation. Zeet made an exaggerated, disgusted noise in the back of his throat, and I smiled.
"What an idiot," he said.
"Not really," I said. "But it's nice of you to say." We drank tea and ate warm bread for dinner. It was not the best meal I had ever had, but it wasn't the worst. The other smugglers kept to themselves, except for Zeet, who sat beside Etrek and told stories from their childhood for hours.
They had us all laughing before long at Etrek's sad attempts to prank his older brother and Zeet's savage retaliations. Then everyone found somewhere to sleep, not an easy task in a room this small, and one by one, we drifted off. I had never been good at sleeping, particularly in places with which I was unfamiliar, so I soon found myself slipping out the back door to sit on the back step, facing the alley.
"Saw you get up."
Tekka sat next to me on the step. "You're not much for sleeping, are you?" "Waste of time," I declared. Tekka nodded.
"It took me a long time to sleep again after..."
She waved a hand over her eye patch.
"Kind of a horrible memory."
"Kind of," I said with a short laugh. "I'm not sure what's worse." I paused, thinking of her mother's public execution. "I didn't mean... sorry."
"You don't have to be so careful around me," Tekka said, looking at me from the corner of her eye. "When I didn't like you, it was because I made too many assumptions. After I let them go, well, I'm here on your crazy mission, aren't I?"
I grinned. "Yeah," I said. "You are."
"I am. So when I bring something up, I don't want you to take it too personally," she said, guarded. "Akos."
"Yeah?" I frowned. "What about him?"
"Honestly," she sighed, "I'm a little worried that when push comes to shove, you'll prioritize saving him over killing Lazmet, now that you know he's here and alive. I've been worried about it since I told you about him."
I sat for a moment, listening to the night air. It was loud in this part of the city, despite the curfew and the aura of depression that had settled over all of Voa. People argued and laughed and played music in their apartments at all hours, or so it seemed. Even in the alley I saw the glow of lanterns still lit, defiant against the night. "You're worried I'll do what I did last time, when I didn't kill Rizek," I said.
"Yes," Tekka said, unflinching. "I am."
"It's different this time," I said. "There's more this time."
"More?"
"More that I care about," I said. "Before, all I had, the only good thing I had, was him. And now, that's not true anymore." She smiled, and I bumped her with my shoulder. Then I heard something behind me. A squeak. The pressure of a foot against an old floorboard. Turning, I saw a dark shape in the living room, the silhouette of a man, a soldier judging by the bulk of him, holding out a current blade. Beneath it, the space where Aija had been, a bump under a blanket, was empty. Aija was gone. And someone else was here. I turned and stood and ran and roared all at once. As the shape bent, blade upraised, I stepped on someone's leg and shoved hard at the intruder. My hands met armor with a crack. I gritted my teeth against the pain of impact and bent at the waist to dodge the swinging blade. Someone had told the Shotet police to come here. I drove my elbow low, under the bottom edge of the armored vest, and hit the man in the groin. He groaned, and I made a grab for his weapon. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Tekka's hair swinging as she leapt at the person behind the first. The smugglers, as well as Etrek, Sifa, and Issa, were now awake and scrambling. The pain of my current gift disappeared in my adrenaline, but I didn't forget it. As I wrenched the blade from the man's hand, I gave in to the desire to share my pain with him, and current shadows crept around his wrist,
merging with the ones that wrapped around his current blade. I watched the two combine and bury themselves in his flesh, now a richer and darker black. He screamed. I kept going. I lunged at the next woman in uniform I saw, grabbing her face instead of her throat, pressing current shadows toward her until she choked on my pain, until it filled her open, gasping mouth. I brought her head down to meet my knee, raised high enough for the two to collide with as tall as I was. I was not afraid of their numbers. I wasn't afraid of anyone. Not anymore. It was what made me a Noavec. Not that I was so powerful I couldn't be threatened, but that I had already survived enough horrors, enough pain, to be accustomed to the inevitability of both. But I was powerful. That much I knew. I kept going, grabbing the next man I could get my hands on. They had made a mistake in invading us through that narrow hallway, because it created a funnel through which only one of them could charge at a time. So I took them on one at a time, until there were no more. Behind me was silence. I assumed the others had left. I turned to make for the back door. I didn't know how many of the police I had killed and how many I had simply disabled, but either way, I needed to flee. When I turned back toward the living room, though, I saw Zeet, Sifa, Etrek, Issa, and Tekka waiting for me, each of them looking a little surprised. Go! I shouted. And we all ran.
Well, your crew don't waste any time fleeing, do they, Zeet?
Tekka huffed, leaning against the wall. We had decided, mid-stride, to make our way for the half-destroyed building where the renegades had made their camp, when I was last on Voa. It was the only other safe place we knew. Tekka had taken the lead, navigating winding streets apparently from memory. The edges of the city were fraying like the cuffs of a shirt, more damaged and broken than closer to the center. There was graffiti scrawled on the side of every building. Simple characters written in black in some places, and in others, sprawling murals of characters as tall as a man, filled in with colors as bright as the current stream. The graffiti covered up the cracks in the buildings, the boards where windows had been, the dirt that dusted each wall with brown. But I was most transfixed by a simple statement, written neatly beneath one windowsill. Noaveks own us.
What do you expect? Zeet replied. They're smugglers. They're not particularly ambitious. We don't need them anyway, Etrek said. Zeet is the one with the contacts. Yes, the contacts for the smuggling of fruit, apparently.
Zeet raised an eyebrow at me. Yes, I said, offering no further explanation.
Now might be a good time to explain what you need a bunch of fruit for, Zeet said.
It might be a good time, I countered. But how can we be sure? I took a vial of painkiller from the pack at my side and tipped it into my throat. It was one of Akos's subpar batches, and he wasn't wrong to call them that. They weren't nearly as effective as most of his painkillers. But it was better than nothing. The plants growing between the cracks in the broken floor had spread much farther in the time we had been away from this place. Vines were beginning to creep up the walls, and everywhere I looked, there were splashes of color from wildflowers. The kind that turned to mush, I thought. And it was an Akos thought, not one of my own. Suddenly, I needed to be alone. I slipped away, into the stairwell where I had first showed Akos that I could control my current gift. My back against one of the stone walls, I slid to the ground and let the tears come. Later, Tekka found a bottle of fermented fruit juice in the cabinets of someone who had lived in this place before it was destroyed, and we all took a glass together to steady ourselves before we tried for more sleep. Sifa offered a toast, translating to Shotet from Thuvazit.
to what we have done, what we are doing, and what we will do. And I drank.
Chapter 46. Akos. His other memories of grief involved time slipping away. Oil beating on water. The sudden lack of presence in his own life. The self-protective drifting. He wished he had that now. Now he felt every tick and every hour. Vakras had come by that morning to a dead-eyed stare, closed his fingers over the pulse in Akos's wrist, and left. Vakras's hands were cold and clammy and then gone. A few days passed before he was summoned to Lazmet's side again. This time he was brought to the weapons hall, the place where he had first learned his fate. Of course, it wasn't really his fate, but he had carried it around for seasons anyway. "Don't trust your heart," that fate had told him, and he'd hated it for that reason. Now he thought it maybe had a point. Lazmet was staring at the wall of weapons, tapping his chin. It was like he was picking out a cheese, Akos thought, and he wondered if he was about to experience some kind of new horror, in which his own father systematically broke his bones or carved out pieces of his flesh. It seemed like the kind of thing Lazmet might do, out of curiosity. It wasn't until she moved out of the shadows that he saw Ema was there. There was a warning in her stare when she gave it to him. And then her mask was back on. That enigmatic smile, the elegant posture. Knowing what he now knew about her, he recognized that she would never be comfortable this way, in a gown, in a manner, playing games with royalty.
"Thank you for your report, Ema," Lazmet said. "You can go."
Ema inclined her head, though Lazmet wasn't looking, still spellbound by the wall of weapons. She brushed Akos's arm on her way out, the brief touch giving some kind of comfort, and a reminder.
"Come here," Lazmet said to him. "I want to show you something."
Akos was supposed to be acting like he was slipping into Lazmet's control, piece by piece, so he climbed the steps to the dais. The room had an eerie green cast to it, light glowing through the row of jars on shelves up higher than Akos's head. White orbs floated in the jars, suspended in green liquid, preservative. They were eyes. Akos tried not to think about it.
"We're not a culture that keeps mementos. After all, that would suggest we trust in some kind of permanence, and the Shotet have always known that objects, places, they can be lost in an instant."
Lazmet gestured to the wall of weapons.
"Weapons, though, we allow ourselves to pass down. They're still useful, you see. So you can trace the history of our family here, on this wall."
He reached for a hatchet on the far left. The blade was rusty from disuse, the metal handle still cloudy with fingerprints.
"We're an old Shotet family, but not old money," Lazmet said, touching his finger to the hatchet blade. "My grandfather killed his way to prominence in our society. This hatchet was his handiwork. He was a weapons maker, not particularly talented. What he lacked in artistry he made up for in brutality when he served in the Shotet army." He put the hatchet away, moving along to a staff. At each end of it were the mechanisms Akos recognized from current blade handles. When Lazmet held it, dark tendrils of current wrapped around first one end of the staff and then the other. My wife's design, Lazmet said, with a smile that almost seemed fond. She was not a talented fighter, but she was theatrical. She knew how to be beautiful and charming and intimidating, all at the same time. It's a shame her life was claimed by someone so unworthy of it. Akko schooled his features to stay blank. I brought you here to eat, Lazmet said. On your restricted diet, I recognize I can't completely deny you food, so I thought we might have dinner. There was a table on the dais, pushed up against the far wall. It didn't seem big enough for the kind of grand dinners that Lazmet probably had, but it was long, about the width of Akos's arm span, and had a seat at either end. Akos thought this was probably all part of Lazmet's strategy, forcing him to eat in the greenish light under jars of eyeballs, in full view of all the weapons the Noavek family had used to bleed their way to the top of Shotet society. He was meant to be unsettled by this. I'm not really in a position to refuse dinner, Akko said. No, you certainly aren't, Lazmet said, smirking as he put the staff back in its place. Near the edge of the wall of weapons was a bell built into the wall. He rang it and gestured to the table for Akos to sit down. Akos did, his head swimming. The food Ema had given him was just enough that he felt his hunger all the time. He drank glass after glass of water just to give his body the impression that it was full of something. The Fenzu that usually swarmed in the globular chandelier were half dead and needed to be replaced. Akos could see the husks of their bodies collected at the bottom of each glass globe, little prickly legs up in the air. Vakraz tells me you are too consumed with self-hatred for him to get a meaningful reading, Lazmet said. Ema assures me that you are progressing, that a vulnerable heart is easier to bend. Akos didn't answer. Sometimes he wondered if Ema was playing a game with him, indulging his desire to kill his father while worming her way in to do her actual work. He had no way of knowing that she was on his side, not really, except her word. A wall panel behind Lazmet pulled back, and three servants filed into the weapons hall, carrying plates covered with protective domes of gleaming metal. They set one plate in front of Lazmet, one in front of Akos, and a third in the center of the table, then backed away. Akos didn't see if they left or if they simply fell into the shadows. I am familiar with how guilty people think, though I myself find guilt to be a worthless emotion, Lazmet said. Why feel bad for a thing you did with full conviction, after all? He hadn't sat down yet. He snapped his fingers, and one of the servants came forward with a cup made of etched glass. She poured something into it, something dark purple and thick, and Lazmet drank. I know that you are thinking there may still be time to undo what you have done to your friend, Lazmet said. It's a last effort to maintain the part of your identity that I most need you to let go of. You are someone who thinks in extremes, and you have placed me, my family, perhaps all of Shotet, in an untouchable, unreachable place inside you that you have labeled bad. He reached across the table to the dome in the center and lifted it. The plate was empty but for a jar, a smaller version of the ones lining the walls. It, too, held greenish preservative, and bobbing inside it were two white globes. Akos tasted bile and roasted dead bird. He could have looked away. He already knew what was in the jar. He didn't need to keep looking. One of the globes turned, showing a dark iris. "I take one eye if I intend to let someone live," Lazmet said. "I take both if they are executed, as Jorak Kuzar was at midnight last night." Akos swallowed reflexively and forced himself to close his eyes. If he kept looking, he would vomit, and he would not give Lazmet the satisfaction of seeing him vomit. "The truth," Lazmet said softly, "is that you cannot undo what you have done. It is too late. You will never be able to return to the people you once counted as friends. So you may as well let go, Akos." There was horror somewhere at the edge of his mind, so close he could touch it without difficulty if he dared. He breathed and drew away from it. "Not now. Not yet. What is your mission?" Akos opened his eyes, staring up at the man whose blood and bone and flesh had conspired to create him. "To kill Lazmet Noavek," came the answer, clearer now than ever before. Lazmet sat down across from him and uncovered his plate, offering the dome to the servant behind him. On his plate was a roll, a piece of cooked meat, and a whole fruit, its peel still on. Lazmet frowned at it. "I didn't think this shipment would come for another week yet," he said, picking up the fruit. Akos recognized the peel from when he had broken into Lazmet's office. A green glimmer caught his eye just over Lazmet's shoulder. The wall panel had slid back, silent, and a dark head was jutting out of the opening. The head lifted, showing a sliver of silver skin and a pair of sharp, dark eyes. Behind Lazmet, Syra raised a current blade about the length of her forearm and made to stab him in the back. Akos didn't stir an Izzet. Lazmet, however, lifted a hand as if signaling for another glass of whatever it was he was drinking, and Syra's hand stopped, right in the middle of her downward swing.
"Syra," Lazmet said, "how kind of you to remember my favorite fruit."
Chapter 47. Syra. My father had never used his current gift on me. That would have required him to acknowledge my existence, which he had preferred not to do. So I had not realized how strange it would feel to be the target of his unique power. I felt him wriggling around in my head, an uncomfortable pressure in the primary central cortex of my brain, which triggered movement. I assumed that was the area he manipulated anyway. It could also have been my cerebellum. Not the time for a debate over anatomy, I scolded myself. Regardless of where he focused his current gift, it was working. My fingers, hand, and arm were completely stiff, holding the blade halfway between where I had raised it and where I had intended to shove it. The rest of my body also seemed to be incapable of movement. Not that it was numb, exactly, but it was like a pile of kindling that refused to take a spark. Everything felt the same, but I couldn't get it to move. He seemed to want me to respond, though, because what small movement I was able to channel was in my mouth and jaw. "No problem," I said, feeling oddly clear-headed, though I knew that I was about to die. My last chance to kill him had been a moment ago, and now it was gone. Lazmet's control over my body was absolute as of the moment he became aware of my presence. Except, I thought. If Akos touches him. I tried to make eye contact with Akos, to somehow communicate what I wanted him to do, but I couldn't move. The wriggling in my brain went deeper, and I felt utter revulsion.